NBC Radio Network celebrates its first Fabulous 50.
Howdy!
Hi-ho, everybody.
Good evening, Mr. First Lieutenant.
Good evening, Mr. and Mr. North American. All the ships at sea, let's go to press.
The only thing we have to fear.
Ladies and gentlemen, easy aces.
Mr. Allen!
We are resolved to destroy Hitler.
Mr. Chairman.
You were expecting maybe Emperor Shapiro Hito?
Everybody awake! Let the word go forth.
Ignition. Lift off.
I have a dream.
Hello, Linda.
I'm mortified.
Flown like a butterfly.
I'm staying like a bee.
Let me make one point clear.
NBC Radio, America's first network, presents highlights from the 5 one-hour shows, celebrating its first 50 years with hosts Ben Grauer, Bob Hope, Bing Crosby, Arlene Francis, and John Chancellor. And with special material by Joe Garagiola, Edwin Newman, and Gene Shalit. And now, Ben Grauer.
It all really began back in 1912, the date April 14th. SS Titanic ran into iceberg, sinking fast. The dots and dashes that spelled out this news were heard by a young wireless operator at a station on top of Wanamaker's department store in New York. For the next 72 hours, without a break, he became the only link with the developing story. As President Taft ordered all other stations to shut down in order to keep this one clear line of communication open. Through this event, David Sarnoff, that was the operator's name, proved to the world the value of radio. In the years that followed, it progressed from dots and dashes to words and music. Then, on the evening of November 15th, 1926, 1,000 elegantly attired guests gathered in the grand ballroom of the old Waldorf Astoria in New York, down on 34th Street, for the first broadcast of the NBC radio network. They, and several million of us at home, listening to one of the 26 stations that made up the network, heard these opening words from NBC's first president, Merlin Aylesworth.
Beginning tonight, you will receive a new thrill in radio. In the future, those engaged in productions will, through the power of radio broadcasting, with the modern radio equipment, offer their talents, whether in song, drama, comedy, or orchestral music.
And NBC radio was on its way. Opera stars sang, orchestras played, comedians made us laugh. One of the very first was Will Rogers, who just loved to poke fun at everybody's favorite target.
With Congress, every time they make a joke, it's a law. And every time they make a law, it's a joke.
Sounds as timely today as it did 50 years ago, doesn't it? And when the opening festivities were over and the network moved on to regular daily broadcasting, our first great comedy stars, Amos and Andy, also found politics a source of fun.
You don't know politics like I do.
Tell me this, though. Why can't they have a Democrat and a Republican president at the same time?
The trouble with that is, the Republican would get everything messed up for the Democrat, and vice versa.
And what?
Vice versa.
He ain't running, is he?
You know, Amos and Andy were so popular that when 7 o'clock rolled around and they were on the air, just about everything stopped. Phone calls, conversation, even meals. Well, comedy and music were what listeners wanted. So NBC went out and got the best. In 1928, Broadway's most exciting star, Al Jolson, joined us.
What do you think has come over me? I can't stand it. I feel a song coming on. Give out. I feel a song coming on, and I'm warning you, it's a victorious, happy and glorious new strain.
And from the Ziegfeld Follies, where he was billed as the perfect fool, Ed Wynn came to NBC, eventually winding up as Texaco's fire chief.
The title of tonight's opera is Rosalie. Rosalie is so fat that when she goes to bed, she reminds you of an ocean liner. It takes a couple of tugs to get her out of a slip. I got some that are worse than that.
Also, from Broadway and the movies, the beloved little banjo eyes, Eddie Cantor. whose wife Ida didn't mind when he sang about other girls.
If you knew Susie like I know Susie, oh, 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 what a girl. There's none so classy as this fair lassie. Oh, 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 my goodness, what a chassis. We went.
Then there was a chap who added the word crooner to our vocabulary, Rudy Vallee, who on his own program played straight man to comedian Jack Pearl, who played the role of Baron Munchausen, teller of tall tales.
Just a second. Do you want me to believe that you swam all the way from New York to South America?
Well, I would prefer it.
Well, I'm not going to believe a thing like that.
Rudy, if you ain't going to believe a thing like that, you're going to have a lot of trouble with the stuff that comes later. You see?
And then there was the man who was not just loved by his audiences, but by his fellow comedians as well, the peerless Jack Benny.
For your information, Don, when I started on radio, I was 22.
What are you talking about? I knew you then and you had gray hair.
Don, I was born with gray hair. I was worried about the doctor bill. I'm glad I didn't pay him slapping me when my back was turned. And Don, here's an amazing coincidence. After all these years, who do you think is sitting in the audience this very moment?
The doctor.
No, his lawyer. The case comes up in court Wednesday.
What a lineup of great talent NBC had right from the start. And that went for newsmen as well. From the earliest days, NBC Radio News brought our listeners something newspapers could never provide: immediacy, the story as it happened. And in addition, the actual voices of those involved. Happy to have John Chancellor with us to illustrate this. John?
Thank you, Ben. The first great example of the concept Ben has just discussed begins on the 20th of May, 1927. The Roaring Twenties, the Jazz Age, 23 Skidoo and OU Kid. Clara Bow was appearing in Rough House Rosie, Lon Chaney and Mr. Wu. The country was thriving, full of hustle and bustle. But at Yankee Stadium that evening, before the heavyweight championship fight between Jack Sharkey and Jim Maloney, 40,000 people stood in silent prayer to wish Godspeed to a young man who, that morning, had started on a flight to immortality. The world waited while monitors reported sightings. Halifax, Nova Scotia. Then Belfast, Ireland. Cherbourg, France. And finally, 33 and a half hours later on NBC Radio.
This is Lowell Thomas in New York. He made it. Charles A. Lindbergh, Lucky Lindy as they call him, landed at Le Bourget Airport, Paris at 5:24 this afternoon, thus becoming the first person to fly New York to Paris nonstop.
Charles Lindbergh, the lone eagle, became the reigning hero of the world. Wild receptions in Paris, London, and when he returned to this country on the U.S. cruiser Memphis, he was greeted by cheering throngs in Washington, D.C. NBC Radio was there in the person of Graham McNamee.
And now the National Broadcasting Company and Associated Radio Stations ask you to just listen to the band for a few moments, because particularly this is the first time band music or music has been transmitted from the Atlantic coast to the Pacific coast.
This was followed by President Coolidge's speech at the Washington Monument.
I bestow the Distinguished Flying Cross as a symbol of appreciation for what he is and what he has done upon Colonel Charles A. Lindbergh.
When Coolidge described Lindbergh, it sounded as though his speechwriter had dipped into a thesaurus.
Intelligent, industrious, energetic, dependable, purposeful, alert, quick of reaction, serious, deliberate.
One attribute the president neglected to include was Lindbergh's sense of humor, which Lindy revealed during a speech at a press club dinner later that day.
When I landed at Le Bourget, I landed with the expectancy and the hope of being able to see Europe. And I wasn't in any hurry to get back. And I was informed that while it wasn't an order to come back home, that there'd be a battleship waiting for me next week.
Lucky Lindy, lucky indeed, although his ability and courage played a decisive role in his success. And when the young hero went on to marry the talented, charming heiress, Anne Morrow, it seemed that all the ingredients for a storybook happy ending had been assembled except one. The birth of their first child, a boy, Charles Augustus Lindbergh Jr., provided that final ingredient.
Lucky Lindy!
But the They Lived Happily Ever After ending was not to be. On April the 3rd, 1936, there was this bulletin on NBC Radio.
The National Broadcasting Company presents a special bulletin, Trenton, New Jersey. Bruno Richard Hauptmann was electrocuted at 8:47 tonight for the murder of the Lindbergh baby.
The death of the German-born carpenter had followed one of the most widely publicized murder trials in history, which marred to the end the life of the first American hero that the public got to know on the radio.
Thank you, John. I'd like to add a brief personal note, if I may, about that kidnapping. As NBC's reporter at the Trenton State Police headquarters, waiting for word, I broadcast the Lindbergh baby's formula in the desperate hope that the kidnappers would hear it and take care of the baby. It was one of the most moving moments of all my years at the network. Earlier we heard some of the great performers who were established stars before they came to NBC. But we also developed our own radio personalities. The Happiness Boys, for instance, Billy Jones and Ernie Hare.
She is gone, let her go. You're not fast, but not too slow. She'll never find a fella like me. Just feel great, you just laugh. I tore up her photograph. She'll never find a fella like me.
No, it's not Renfrew of the Mounted. This was the opening theme of the Clico Club Eskimos. Harry Reeser, leading his musicians, clad in fur parkas. They were really wearing fur parkas. I wore a tuxedo. See, I was the announcer. In the comedy department, there were Easy Aces.
That money is in a bank to stay, and he's
not... Oh, all right. The minute you mention that money, you fly off the coop.
I'll fly off the coop when you start talking about our nest egg that we laid away for later on. There's nothing you need that money for now.
Oh, well, we could travel and meet new people. I get tired of the same couples all the time. You know how they say, familiarity breeds attempt.
Isn't that awful? Would you mind if we don't discuss this anymore? I'd like to finish my paper here.
And wherever you live, coast to coast, you didn't have to pay a personal visit to Manhattan to enjoy its music. NBC provided instant travel.
Jump on the Manhattan merry-go-round. We're touring, alluring the New York town. Broadway, a Harlem, a musical show. We are guests as you rest at your radio.
We had music from the big city, and we had comedy about small-town families. One of the most lovable and most witty was Vic Insane. Here Vic is playing Rummy with his teenage son, Rush.
Your sweet face is painted with a happy leer. I apprehend you think you've won the game.
I have won the game. Look here.
Hey, hey.
You fellas done with your Rummy?
Dry Rot just blundered into an accidental victory.
It's always accidental when I win.
Better hop into that algebra study and hadn't you, son?
Algebra sure is a rotten topic. Fails to hold an individual's interest.
You'll feel an individual's interest where you don't want it if that report card ain't up to snuff this time.
Oh.
Rush, get your feet down from there.
I enjoy the sensation of twisting my spine out of shape.
Get him down, I said.
Twist his spine out of shape. Kids in the 30s weren't very different from kids today, were they? But when it came to music, we had someone with us at NBC then who was unique. As a singer of light classical music, she was supreme. Jessica Dragonette, queen of radio. I can see her now, standing center stage in the old Cathedral Studio at 711 Fifth Avenue. A slight figure, golden-haired, a firm little chin tilted high, and the notes pouring out.
Kiss me,
From the Cathedral Studio, we drop in at 79 Wistful Vista, where Fibber McGee and Molly are in the kitchen.
McGee never helps me wash the dirty dishes, McGee.
Come in. You kids want to buy any Easter eggs?
No, thank you, Mr. Oldtimer. I don't believe we want any.
Oh, come on, kids. Well, I'll see you later, kids. Sorry I didn't want any Easter eggs.
Hey, that's the wrong door, old
man. No, dear, that's the closet door.
Oh, no. Ain't you kids ever going to straighten out that gosh darn museum?
We're glad they never got it straightened out because it never failed to give us a laugh. Still does. Like any healthy youngster, the NBC radio network was full of curiosity. We were willing to try just about anything. We even had Ben Burney, the old maestro, trying to do on-the-scene coverage of a scientific balloon flight. Ben was better at band leading. But when it came to sports, NBC was there, fustest with the mostest. Graham McNamee with the first coast-to-coast Rose Bowl in 1927. And then, in 1929, at the Kentucky Derby, Clem McCarthy calling the run for the roses down the homestretch.
Look out! On the outside! Here comes the California Colt, Nature Bird. He's coming at Clyde Van Dusen. The Kentucky Pony Marketing shakes his whip, and the son of Mighty Man of War comes away. Clyde Van Dusen by 3 lengths.
In 1934, heavyweight boxing champion Primo Carnera was losing to challenger Max Baer. And Graham McNamee was there.
Carnera has fallen. Carnera has fallen again. But he is up instantly. The man won't stay down. Talk about nerve. He'll fight till he's dead, that man. He'll fight till nothing can stop him. Carnera is almost through, though.
Thanks to Graham's blow-by-blow description, folks listening to NBC at home had a much better idea of what was going on in the ring than most of the paying customers out there in the far reaches of Yankee Stadium. And there was a bonus for radio listeners. Graham brought a perspiring pugilist into their homes that night to deliver what eventually became the traditional greeting to a prize fighter's best friend, his mother.
And now I'll have Max Baer over here in a minute, who has just won the heavyweight championship of the world.
Graham,
Joe Humphreys is now raising Max Baer's hand in token of winning.
Hello, Mom.
Hello, Mom. From Max Baer, the victor's valedictory. But radio didn't just confine itself to fun and games. When the great floods of the middle 30s swept across the Ohio and Mississippi River valleys, our NBC affiliates there didn't just report the disaster, but they took an active part in the rescue work. Among them, WLW in Cincinnati, WAVE in Louisville, and in Memphis, Tennessee, station WMC did its share.
To the residents of Ashport, Tennessee and vicinity, Potter Dredge boat is now at Ashport and will take refugees picked up at Gold Dust and inhabitants of Ashport to Ashport Bluff tomorrow. Anyone wanting to get out, come to Jap Henderson's store at Ashport tonight or as early as possible. We repeat a message that we gave...
From that day to this, through flood, tornado, hurricane, earthquake, whenever help has been needed, radio has been there. From our earliest days, NBC has pioneered just about all the varied features broadcast on radio and television. Back in 1929, for example.
You? Is anybody?
That's the way the Goldbergs began. And Molly and Jake and their children, Rosalie and Sammy, made the daily dramatic serial an instant success thanks to the warm, humorous nature of the show, very close to reality. Other daytime dramas which followed drifted away from this reality, became known as soap operas because of their melodramatic storylines and the nature of their sponsors' products. Among them were Road to Life, Porsche Faces Life, and these.
The story of young Dr. Malone, dedicated to those men and women whose selfless service has inspired it, our doctors.
And now, Stella Dallas, a continuation on the air of the true-to-life story of mother love and sacrifice, in which Stella Dallas saw her beloved daughter Laurel marry into wealth and society, and realizing the difference in their social world, went out of Laurel's life.
One Man's Family is dedicated to the mothers and fathers of the younger generation and to their bewildering offspring. Tonight we present Chapter 7, Book 43, entitled The Man Who Lay With His Face in the Leaves.
They weren't kidding. That was really the title of the episode. We saw new programs added almost every month to the NBC roster. Religious programs, broadcasts from the Metropolitan Opera. A new type of show called panel shows. And we heard new superstars in the making. On October 26, 1935, Wallace Beery, gruff, tough, and lovable movie star, was host to a 12-year-old girl.
Now, what do you want to do when you grow up to be a great big girl, huh?
I want to be a singer, Mr. Beery. And I'd like to act, too.
Well, you'll do it. Don't worry. I'll go right to it. If you need me, I'll be standing right there. Got a name.
Got a name. Everybody dance. Broadway rhythm, it's got me. Everybody dance. Out on the gay white way, in each merry cafe, orchestras play, taking your breath away. With the Broadway rhythm, it's got me. Everybody sing.
Judy Gott, 12 years old, showing then all the skill that made her one of the greatest entertainers of our age. Well, that's a tough act to follow, but there are a couple of fellas who can manage it, both of them hosting their own shows for many years here on NBC.
First, I'd like to hear you sing.
Okay. When the blue of the night meets the gold of the day, someone waits for me.
Well, what do you think, Mr. Holt? Let me see your feet. My feet, fire. Well, with that voice, you'll make a wonderful grape crusher.
The prospective grape crusher was Bing Crosby, of course. And the cheerfully caustic comments came from Bob Hope. Well, this is where I get off. But rather than my saying, this is Van Grauer, etc., etc., listen to what the late H.V. Kaltenborn, first dean of NBC Newsmen, once said about this traditional pause.
The announcer would suck in his breath and rattle off, "This is station WEAF, WJR, WTAG, WTIC, WLIT, WCSH, naming every station on the hookup." That was in 1926. A few months, and several breathless announcers later, we bought the electrical chimes. They cost only $48.50 at the time, but think of all the trouble they save as we now take a short pause for station identification.
Yes, this is Bob NBC. That's NBC for Night Before Christmas, because I feel like Santa Claus with a sack of supersounds to hang on your radio antenna, Hope. Bringing back our second decade when NBC radio really came of age. And I'm sure that when this hour's over, you'll be singing Thanks for the Memory right along with me. At our 10th birthday celebration in 1936, the General, the man who started it all, David Sarnoff, summed it up in one short sentence.
In 10 years, radio broadcasting has grown from an exotic novelty to a daily necessity.
How right he was. And the daily quota began for NBC listeners at breakfast time with this program from Chicago.
Presenting America's favorite, the NBC Breakfast Club with Don McNeil.
Good morning, everybody. Good morning to you. We woke up bright and early to howdy do ya. The coffee's on, the fruit, the toast, the bacon, and the skillet, and Everett Mitchell is nuts.
Later in the day, there was the soap operas, of course. Mom Wept. The kids, they weren't interested in such mushy grown-up stuff. You couldn't drag them away from the radio, however, when the King of the West galloped into earshot every afternoon.
with the speed of light, a cloud of dust, and a hearty high-o silver, the Lone Ranger.
Then in the evenings, programs the whole family could enjoy together.
I love to spend each Sunday with you.
Eddie Cantor was our man on Sundays. I had my show on Tuesdays. And we used to trade visits.
Hey, Bob.
Yes, sir.
I was on your program Tuesday night, and now you're on my show. You know we make a great team, Bob and Eddie?
Yeah, hope and hopeless.
I was kidding, of course. Eddie was anything but hopeless when it came to performing. Yes, you could count on NBC to keep you entertained, and you could also count on us for the latest news. On May 6, 1937...
Lakehurst, New Jersey. The German dirigible Hindenburg is on fire. It is reported that the entire ship is involved. The Hindenburg had been...
What actually was happening was described at the scene by reporter Herbert Morrison.
They back motors of the ship are just holding it just enough to keep it from... The first in the flame. Get it started. It's rising terrible. Oh, my. Get out of the way, please. It's burning, bursting into flames, and it's falling on the mooring fast. And all the folks between the ship is terrible. This is the worst of the worst catastrophes in the world. Oh, it's like running. Oh, 400 or 500 feet into the sky, and it's a terrific crash, ladies and gentlemen. The smoke and the flames now, and the frame is crashing to the ground, not quite to the mooring mast.
Well, our sympathy went out to the victims of the tragedy involving that German airship. But only a year later, we cheered like mad when a German prize fighter was practically pulverized at Yankee Stadium. Joe Louis not only knocked out Max Schmeling, but flattened Adolf Hitler's racist theory of Aryan supremacy. Back in 1938, an Englishman with a rolled-up umbrella, Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain, returned from Munich, waving a piece of paper and said, "Peace in our time." And most of the world gave a big sigh of relief. The following June, King George VI and his wife paid us a visit. NBC Radio broadcast a special program in honor of the royal pair, with an incredible musical performance by the distinguished actors Nigel Bruce, Sir Cedric Hardwick, and C. Aubrey Smith.
Down in the meadow, in a little bitty pool, swam three little fishes and a mamma fishy too. Swim, said the mamma fishy, swim if you can. And they swam all over the dam. Boop, boop, dittum, dottum, wottum, chew. Boop, boop, dittum, dottum, wottum, chew. Boop, boop, dittum, dottum, wottum, chew. And they swam all over the dam. Boop, boop, dittum, dottum, wottum, chew. Boop, boop, dittum, dottum, wottum, chew. Boop, boop, dittum, dottum, wottum, chew.
And they swam right over the dam.
And back to Britain the king and queen went. But it was only 10 weeks later that this voice was heard from Germany, with NBC's Max Jordan translating the key words.
From now on, bomb will be met by bomb.
Then on September the 1st, 1939...
Ladies and gentlemen, we interrupt this broadcast for some last-minute bulletins. Warsaw. The Foreign Office said today that German planes had bombed Krakow and Katowice in southwestern Poland. Military operations...
And finally on Sunday the 3rd, after an ultimatum demanding that the Germans agree to end the hostilities, British Prime Minister Chamberlain broadcast to his nation and to the world.
I have to tell you now that no such undertaking has been received, and that consequently this country is at war with Germany.
World War II had begun. From our NBC correspondents in Europe, we got continuing reports of the Nazis' victorious march through Europe. First Poland, then Belgium, Holland, France, followed by the British evacuation from Dunkirk. Then in June 1940, Winston Churchill began to rally his people.
Let us therefore brace ourselves to our duty, and so bear ourselves that if the British Empire and its commonwealths last for 1,000 years, men will still say, this was their finest hour.
And old Winnie was right. The Nazis' air blitz of Britain began. Terror bombing of London, Liverpool, Coventry, and many other cities. But the British took it all and fought back. NBC newsmen stayed on the job, too, and on one occasion hung a microphone outside the studio while they were on the air so we could hear an actual air raid in progress.
This is London at about 23 minutes past 1 o'clock. Fred Bates speaking. London is now having its 25th successive night raid. Lord Wolfen appealed to coffee stores. The cops have used to sell coffee and meat pies to night workers and people just out at night to reopen their businesses as a help in feeding the homeless. The minister promised that the coffee store orders would be given gasoline, food, and air raid shelters.
While the war in Europe went on, FDR was re-elected for an unprecedented third term. In the non-political world, the public's choice included NBC's great slate of musical programs. There was this one, for example, over station WSB Atlanta.
I'm honored with the assignment of introducing our master of ceremonies on this NBC program, the cherished chancellor of NBC's College of Musical Knowledge, Professor K. Kaiser. Welcome, South Kaiser.
Evening, folks. Hi-yo. Well, chillin', here's a sight to behold, one that could never be put in words, and I'm not even gonna try. We've got lots to tell you later on, but right now, come on, chillin', let's dance.
Oh, Johnny, how you can love.
Yes, dance, chillin', he said, and they did. Country music got a better than fair shake, too, at the Grand Ole Opry.
Here's Charlie Walker.
Only you could steal my heart away from me. Only you could win my love so tenderly.
Sounds like she stepped on a snake. Barefoot.
Only you could make me love you like I do. Only you.
And there were other kinds of musical shows. Fred Waring's Pennsylvania, The Telephone Hour, The Voice of Firestone, which all seemed to have one thing in common. Tenors who specialized in high notes.
That is will of him.
Had a tenor on my show, too. He could not only hit high notes, but could shatter glass.
And the dawn comes up like thunder. China, everybody awake! And the bass!
Oh, he's beautiful. Jerry Colonna, what a talent. And he could deliver a punchline with the best, too.
Hello, Hope. I'm calling you from Canada.
From Canada? Why are you talking so loud?
No telephone.
Well, we had great times in those shows. On September the 14th, 1940, President Roosevelt's fellow Americans listened to this broadcast with more than just passing interests.
The first number drawn by the Secretary of War is serial number 158.
That scream came from the mother of one of the young men whose number was picked, which made him eligible for the first peacetime draft. Anyway, aside from the draft, life went on much as before. All you had to do was join Fred Allen for a stroll down his alley.
Somebody, I say, somebody now.
Yes, I know.
Claghorn's the name, Senator Claghorn.
I know. You're from Dixie.
When I eat crackers in bed, I only eat Georgia crackers.
Now, wait a minute.
Way down upon the Swanee River.
Look, you're a little...
I'm singing Swanee songs.
Well, I know what you're singing.
Show some reverence, son. Kneel down and uncover.
Now, wait a minute. Now, I wonder how Titus Moody is doing.
Howdy, bub.
Tell me, Mr. Moody, do you have any trouble sleeping?
I only half sleep.
Half sleep?
I got short eyelids.
Let's try this next door here.
No.
Oh, Mrs. Nussbaum.
You are expecting maybe Hoagy Carbuncle.
Tell me, Mrs. Ann, do you have trouble sleeping?
Who could sleep? Every night with his dreaming, my husband Pierre is waking me up.
He dreams, huh?
One night, Pierre is dreaming he is the lone stranger.
Yeah.
All night long, he is yelling, "Hi-ho, Silver!"
Hi-ho, Silver, huh?
Upstairs is living a Mr. Silver.
Yeah.
All night, he is yelling back, "Hi-ho, Nussbaum!"
Love that, Mrs. Nussbaum. You were expecting maybe Hoagy Carbuncle. In 1941, the Sammy Kay Show was interrupted by this bulletin.
The Japanese have attacked the Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, from the air. I'll repeat that. President Roosevelt says that the Japanese have attacked Pearl Harbor in Hawaii from the air.
Pearl Harbor wasn't the only place under attack.
Hello, NBC. This is Bert Salmon speaking from Manila.
Manila has just been bombed. In fact, right now it is being bombed. And without warning, Japanese bombers started bombing Fort William McKinley, Nichols Airfield, and the RCA transmitting station.
Next day, radio brought this message to the nation.
Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy. United States of America.
The war we'd been watching from the sidelines was now our war, too. And FDR expressed the feelings of our people with these final words.
No matter how long it may take us to overcome this premeditated invasion, the American people in their righteous might will win through to absolute victory.
Our lives changed from that moment on, and so did radio. From Pearl Harbor on, NBC radio became wartime radio. And all kinds of performers took their talents to where the troops were.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Bob. Don't ask me where I am because I don't know. And even if I did know, I couldn't tell because it's a military secret, Hope. Well, I want to tell you, it's a thrill to be here. And I've got very little to report from home. Outside of their drafting all the leading men in Hollywood. That is, the young leading men.
Crosby's still there.
You know, if it keeps up, most of the leading men next season will be on the adrenaline side. Can you imagine Hedy Lamarr waiting to be kissed while Lewis Stone looks around for a place to plug in his heating pad?
There were NBC correspondents on all the European fighting fronts, of course. North Africa, Sicily, Italy. And finally, from the invasion fleet off the Normandy beaches, on D-Day came this historic report by George Hicks.
Here we go again, another plane to come over.
There he goes.
They got one.
We got that one. Just got it right here.
Did we?
Yeah.
This one?
Just off our port side in the sea. The lights of that burning Nazi plane are just twinkling now in the sea and going out.
And this was the same fellow who used to report the Easter Sunday parades in New York over a microphone concealed in his top hat. Came a long way from that, didn't he? And when Paris was finally liberated, correspondent John McVain reported it from in front of Notre Dame Cathedral.
We just came in this morning with the first correspondent, the first American car to come in with these French troops. And we've just had a big street fight here right in the square in front of the cathedral. And now all the church bells in the city are beginning. I can hear three or four more churches. And I'm...
In October that year, 1944, there was another kind of celebration. Returning to his weekly radio show after entertaining our troops in France, my man Crosby was broadcasting from New York and discovered he had a surprise guest in a Hollywood studio.
Say, Bing, I suppose you know Bob Hope was in London ahead of you.
Yeah, but they're rebuilding the city.
Oh.
a minute.
Whoa. I heard that. I heard that blub. I heard it. You can't stand there in New York and slander me, you know.
Oh, my word, we're cooked.
I guess you'd like to get back to France, huh?
Oh, mais oui, c'est demain.
Get a load of that chubby Charles Boyer. Oh, my. Look, Slagbag, did you tell the boys at the front I'll be over next year?
I did, Bob, and it was fine for morale.
No kidding.
Yeah. They all said in that case we better finish it this year.
Ah, Bing may have been kidding, but our soldiers weren't. Within 6 months, they fought their way through France, across the Rhine, and into Germany. The news was good, but on April 12, 1945, H.V. Kaltenborn brought us this news from the home front.
Good afternoon, everybody. The President of the United States died at 3:35 p.m. this afternoon in the Warm Springs environment that he loved so much.
What made the president's death even more tragic was the fact that if he had lived just a few weeks longer, he could have enjoyed the news of the victory for which he had worked so hard. NBC's W.W. Chaplin, my good friend Bill, reported the signing of the German surrender in Reims on May the 8th.
General Yodel walked straight to his place at the center of the table, threw his cap on the table, and sat down without a gesture or a word to anyone. And then the others sat down. A few quiet words from General Smith, and the chief of documents were laid in front of Yoder. He was handed a pen. He was told to sign. He signed. After General Yoder had signed the surrender document, it was signed by General Smith for the Western Allies, by General Kosloporov for Russia, and by General Sevres for the French. And it was done, all in 4 minutes. A war that lasted almost 6 years was ended just like that, in 4 minutes.
One war was over and we celebrated, but only briefly. There was still the other one in the Pacific. As the war in the Pacific entered its final stages, NBC Radio kept our listeners informed via newscasts and bulletins. But even folks on the home front needed relaxation, and they got it from programs like these.
Grand Central Station.
Drawn by the magnetic force of the fantastic metropolis, day and night, great planes rush toward the Hudson River, sweep down its eastern bank for 140 miles, flash briefly by the long red row of tenement houses south of 125th Street, dive with a roar into the 2.5 mile tunnel which burrows beneath the glitter and swank of Park Avenue, and then Grand Central Station.
After an opening like that, you hardly needed the story that followed. Then, just a short ride across town, there was more drama.
Up Broadway, into traffic jams, across 42nd Street, into the heart of Theaterland. There ahead is the little theater off Times Square. Well, here we are.
Have your tickets ready, please. Have your tickets ready, please.
Good evening, Mr. First Nighter. The usher will show you to your seat.
Thank you. We'll go right in.
And how about the adventures of Sherlock Holmes, with a super sleuth portrayed by Basil Rathbone and his slightly sappy sidekick, Dr. Watson, acted by Nigel Bruce.
Ready now. I'll open the door.
You wanted me?
No, you don't.
Take that!
What the...
Easy, Watson, easy.
All right, Holmes, I've got him.
Well, let's take a look at that catch.
Hi, it's Colonel Valentine Walter, Sir James's brother.
Quite. Well, sir, one of you to say for yourself. Why did you steal the Bruce Partington plans?
Who are you? What do you know about this?
I am Sherlock Holmes, and I know everything.
I don't know about that. Then, on August the 6th, during a Fred Waring program...
The White House has just made an important announcement on the war. And to bring you this story, we interrupt our program... take you to the NBC newsroom in Washington.
This is Ralph Howard Peterson in Washington. I have just returned from the White House, where it has just been announced that the United States is now using an atomic bomb, the most powerful explosive yet developed.
Hiroshima was destroyed. Then on August the 9th, Nagasaki. On September the 1st, the signing of the Japanese surrender was broadcast to the world.
Attention, the peoples of the world. World War II is about to come to its official closing. We're on the Pacific Fleet flagship USS Missouri in Tokyo Bay for the signing of the surrender of Japan.
The generals and admirals and statesmen signed the necessary papers, and then General Douglas MacArthur spoke.
Let us pray that peace be now restored to the world, and that God will preserve it always. These proceedings are closed.
And that was it. The end of the war. The end of an era. So, a little gentle traveling music, Professor, please. Hey, thanks for the memory. Those great years at NBC. I'll tell you, they're happy ones for me. And full of every kind of sound. From letter A through Z. That's right, Z. Zazu Pitts was a guest once. How lovely it's been. And thanks for that top flight news of sports and interviews. The first class folks we use, like Lowell Thomas, Carlton Bourne, Brinkley, Chancellor, to name a few. Hey, how thrilling it's been. And many's the joke that we've laughed at. I mean, from Jack Benny, Fred Allen, George Burns, and Gracie, Ed Wynn, Eddie Cannon. They all took turns. Did I mention Bob Burns? Yes, indeed. Thanks for the memory. You know, I could go on and on, but there just doesn't begin to be enough time to say thanks for all the great memories NBC Radio has provided. And next week, your host will be... Hey, but let's have a bit of a quiz program here. See if you can identify this voice.
What ho there, Flab and Gab. Nice to be back on the road with you, even if it is on separate weekends.
No need to tell you who that is, right? And he might even sing a song, too. That's a warning. So you be sure to listen next week to the wonderful memories from decade number 3 here on NBC. I'll be listening along with you. This is Bob Hope. Thank you so much.
When the blues of the night meets the gold of the day, someone waits for me.
From a well-earned vacation, Bing AWOL Crosby.
AWOL, what's this AWOL?
I guess I'd better explain here. That was Crosby circa 1946 with my man Ken Carpenter on the old Kraft Music Hall. And I'm delighted to report back for duty for this anniversary get-together to guide you through some of those post-war years. There's always been a fine crop of comedic talent on hand here at NBC, so why don't we sample some of that first? There was the show which began with "Hello, Darcy's Tavern," where the elite meet to eat. Archie, the manager, speaking. No, Duffy ain't here, but Miss Duffy usually was.
Archie, did Larry Adler get here yet?
Now wait, Miss Duffy. If you so much as pucker a toenail at Larry Adler,
exactly what would you like me to do? Meet fellows on street corners?
What's wrong with that?
That sort of thing just doesn't work, and I know because I tried every corner in town.
you got to give Miss Duffy credit for trying. And while we're at it, how about a king-sized portion of kudos for Bob Burns, who was such a joy on my show?
Well, Sir Bing, this little fish was sticking its little head right up out of the water.
Mm-hmm.
Just kind of blowing bubbles and going boo-boo-boo-boo-boo at me. He said boo-boo-boo until I just had to take it with me.
Hmm.
And all the way back to camp, he just kept wagging his tail and saying boo-boo-boo-boo at me
boo-boo-boo.
Until there was only one thing left for me to do.
You brought him here?
No, I ate him for breakfast.
Well, I certainly should have put a stop to his boo-boo-boo-booing.
No, Sir Bing, it didn't.
He continued the boo-boo-boo?
Yes, sir, once before I ate him and twice after.
Hand him the bicarb. But enough of the mere morsels of comedy. Let's have a main course. from a Burns and Allen show. The time that Jack Benny, who, well, he always played a penny pincher, invited George and Gracie to be his dinner guests at the Brown Derby.
Oh, waiter, we're ready to order.
Yes, sir. Would Madame like to start with a cocktail?
Oh, no, thanks. I never drink.
I meant a shrimp cocktail.
No matter how small it is, I never drink.
Mrs. Burns will have a steak, and I'll have a broiled lobster.
Well, they're both very good here, but as long as you're in the Brown Derby, you really should order the specialty of the house, you see, crackers and milk.
Oh, I've changed my mind. I won't have a steak.
Good.
I'll have lamb chops.
Madame will enjoy the lamb chops. We serve them with little paper panties on.
Well, don't your legs get cold?
Through the years here at NBC, music of superior quality and copious quantity has always been readily available. In 1950, this Academy Award song.
Mona Lisa, Mona Lisa, men have named you. You're so like a lady with a mystic smile.
Yes, the late, great Nat King Cole. I had the pleasure of playing host to him on the Old Craft Music Hall in what you might call his pre-Renaissance period. Now from the center of the supper club floor, Barry Como directs his song to those in love, wherever they may be.
Limp as a glove, and feeling like someone in love.
Easy to understand why Perry never had to go back to cutting hair for a living. Anniversaries and birthdays call for toasts. So if you'll raise your glasses, put something in it, of course, first, join in the toast that lovable old Victor Moore addressed to equally lovable Jimmy Durante on an NBC show many years ago.
I heard that yesterday was your birthday. Well, I just want to wish you many, many happy returns of the day.
Thanks, Victor. That touches me deeply.
I'm not one for making speeches, Jim, but as you slide down the banister of life, may the splinters never be pointed the wrong way.
I'm a lonely soldier sitting in Korea.
They called it the war the songwriters forgot, so the GIs made up their own songs. It wasn't officially labeled a war, but a United Nations police action which started back in June 1950. And ground right on through the elections of 1952 into 1953. Ike made this campaign promise.
I shall go to Korea.
Finally, in July of 1953, an armistice was signed. But 23 years later, we've still got GIs in Korea. They still may be singing this song.
And them rotation papers sure is hard to get.
Tell me, do the initials A.T. and the phrase musical genius strike a familiar chord? I was referring, of course, to the musical genius, Arturo Toscanini, who had a unique relationship with NBC Radio. We've put together sort of a miniature biography and sound of the great conductor. And Ben Grauer, who was closely associated with the maestro's performances, narrates it.
On June 25th, 1886, in Rio de Janeiro, the conductor of a touring opera company from Italy was taken ill just before a performance. A 19-year-old cellist of the orchestra was persuaded to take over. He conducted the entire opera superbly and from memory. From that moment on, the name of Arturo Toscanini became one of the most famous in the history of music, as triumph followed triumph for half a century. Then, in 1936, he resigned from the New York Philharmonic, which he had conducted for 11 years, to return to his native Italy and retirement. But the perseverance of one man, David Sarnoff, brought him back. I had the memorable experience of being musical commentator for most of the maestro's performances. They were broadcast from Studio 8H in Radio City, and when that wasn't big enough for the thousands who wanted to attend, Carnegie Hall. At rehearsals, very often, the maestro's famous temper would blow sky high.
Non posso mai, I cannot hear. Never, never, never. La 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 la. You look at me, you believe that I am crazy? No. No. A sensitive, yes. Da capo.
Da capo, from the top. On they went. Toscanini and the NBC Symphony toured the country one year, and he provided a rousing encore in Richmond, Virginia in 1950 the folks down there have never forgotten. Then on April 4th, 1954, in Carnegie Hall, last concert. The final work, the prelude for Wagner's Die Meistersinger. I was there, in the control room, like everyone else, filled with emotion, growing almost unbearably tense, as the end of the fabulous career approached. As the last chord sounded, the baton dropped from the maestro's hand. Arturo Toscanini turned, walked off the stage, and into musical immortality.
That was Ben Grauer, sharing some very moving moments with us. Say, would you run on that short fellow with the crew cut, please?
There was an ad in the paper just last week. It was a company seeking fresh capital, and it was one of those typical small manufacturing companies, and it was called the Typical Small Manufacturing Company, and they manufacture typical smalls.
Getting his typical large laughs is George Gobel. In the No Laughing Matter department in 1954, there was Senator Joseph R. McCarthy of Wisconsin in what became known as the Army-McCarthy hearings. McCarthy got into bitter wrangles with some of his fellow senators and with the Secretary of the Army and others. But possibly the most damaging confrontation for him was the elderly Boston lawyer representing the Army, Joseph Welch.
Have you no sense of decency, sir? At long last, have you left no sense of decency?
Listen, I know this hurts you, Mr. Welch.
I'll
but
say
may,
it
may
hurts.
May I say, Mr. Chairman, Mr. as a point of personal privilege, I'd like to finish this.
Senator, I think it hurts you too, sir.
Well, Mr. Welch was right. It did hurt him. Well, turning from acrimony to harmony, I remember an NBC show when Mary Martin and a friend, well, we managed a pretty close blend.
What a wonderful wedding there will be. What a wonderful day for you and me.
Church bell will toll.
You will be mine.
That very same program, I believe, Bert Lahr achieved a musical pinnacle that has never been equaled.
Yes. I love life, and I want to live, and drink of life's fullest, and of all it can give. I love life, I want to live.
Oh, Crosby, you're a bum.
Well, after that, there's nowhere to go but home. Fantastic. Well, just one thing before we close up shop. I'd like you to know that you're going to be in the very best of hands belonging to a charming lady. Listen. And see if you can guess her name.
I'm addicted to caviar, radio, and being called charming by the master of charm himself, Bing Crosby.
Kind of you to say so, dear lady. And if any further hint is needed, her initials are Arlene Francis.
Whose very first show on NBC Radio was What's My Name? But since you already know that answer, what is the name of the exciting new program concept that began NBC's fourth decade? Here's a clue. Right, monitor. Our motto was going places and doing things. And we called our hosts communicators. And no one could communicate better or more warmly than Dave Garraway.
Isn't that a mad noise? That's Monitor's trademark, and we'll call your attention to the show most any time you hear it.
And if there was something unusual to be heard, you heard it on Monitor.
Partly cloudy. Birmingham, 74. Partly cloudy. Atlanta, 73.
Miss Monitor, she could make even a rainy day seem sunny. And on Monitor, you met and sometimes really got to know the most famous people of the day. Marilyn Monroe, for instance.
I remember when I was a kid sitting in the front row at the movies on Saturday afternoon, and I think how wonderful it would be to be an actress and so forth, but I didn't really realize about acting. However, I realized more and more the responsibility. And it is a responsibility, and I would like to be a good actress.
On a less serious note, a lot less. The comedians who were featured on Monitor in those days, they were pretty far out. Ernie Kovacs was one.
In an attempt to produce an intelligent monkey that would also have great courage, Pepe Ortega crossbred a Capuchin monkey with a wild Brahma bull that had fought six toreadors. What he created, however, was not a brave monkey, but a bull that climbed buildings and collected pennies in a tin cup.
I woke up this morning with my mind set on freedom.
In the real world, the struggle by black Americans for their share of the rights guaranteed by the Constitution, these began to accelerate. Some barriers had been broken, but there was strong, often violent opposition. Joe Garagiola witnessed this at first hand as a Major League Baseball player before he came to NBC.
Right, Arlene. I was on the St. Louis Cardinals the year that Jackie Robinson became the first black player to come to the major leagues with the Brooklyn Dodgers. I know of no other man who could have done what Jackie Robinson did. The abuse that he had to take from some of the players and from some of the fans, well, fierce, that's the only word I can think of. But Robinson had the courage to take it. But when it came to really big league bigotry, though, it had nothing to do with sports. In Montgomery, Alabama, in 1956, a rally was held.
Knights of the Ku Klux Klan have saved America twice in history. And if this country is saved again, it'll be the Knights of the Ku Klux Klan that'll do it.
Amen.
I say to you that this is a white man's country, and we do not have...
What brought this on? Well, a few months earlier, Rosa Parks, a black woman, had refused to move to the back of the bus, a city bus. She was arrested and fined $14. The leaders of the black community called for a bus boycott, and a new voice was heard.
This will be a spiritual movement, and I believe that on this day and at this hour, we will have the full cooperation of 99 9/10% of the Negroes in Montgomery. And like Enoch of old, I believe that we are determined to walk with God.
That was the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., then a Montgomery pastor. He was later arrested, had his home bombed, but the boycott went on. Then on December 21st, 1956,
the year-old protest against city buses is officially called off, and the Negro citizens of Montgomery are urged to return to the buses tomorrow morning on a non-segregated basis.
And with this victory, Martin Luther King became a national figure. Well, there you have it, Arlene. The civil rights movement got a tremendous lift, but as we all know, there were rough times ahead.
There were indeed. Thank you, Joe. On NBC Radio from the mid-50s on, Monitor enlivened the airwaves, but it was not alone. There was its weeknight counterpart, Nightline, and of course some grand old favorites too. This one, for example.
the National Farm and Home Hour.
From 1928 on, this program provided valuable information and warm-hearted humor under the guidance of a delightful host.
As a service to agriculture, in cooperation with the United States Department of Agriculture, Ellis Chalmers Manufacturing Company presents the National Farm and Home Hour. It's a beautiful day in Chicago. Yes, this is your old friend Everett Mitchell. The temperature is 16 degrees above zero. Humidity is 79%. Oh, it's a little on the cloudy side, but a great day to be alive. I hope it's even more beautiful wherever you are.
Everett made it beautiful. On another long-lived program, which is still going strong today, you met the people who made the headlines. On Meet the Press, among the guests of Lawrence Bivak, was this visitor from Cuba.
What we want is to get as soon as possible the condition for free election. Not in any condition more than 4 years.
Promises, promises. That was Fidel Castro, 17 years ago. 3 years later, Cuba became the center of a crisis which brought the world to the edge of doom. At the United Nations, our ambassador, Adlai Stevenson, confronted the Soviet ambassador in a distinctly undiplomatic manner.
Do you, Ambassador Zorin, deny that the USSR has placed and is placing medium and intermediate range missiles and sites in Cuba? Yes or no? Don't wait for the translation. Yes or no?
The Russian didn't answer yes or no, as his interpreter indicated.
Sir, will you please continue your statement? You will have your answer in due course.
I'm prepared to wait for my answer until hell freezes over, if that's your decision.
We didn't have to wait that long. Our government took countermeasures, among other things, blockaded Cuba. And then this announcement from the president.
The evidence to date indicates that all known offensive missile sites in Cuba have been dismantled.
There was a huge sigh of relief. President Kennedy became the hero of the hour. But if there's one thing we are in this country, it's irreverent about our heroes. A comedy album titled The First Family became a national favorite.
Family, family, family. Jack, there's just too much family. Can't we ever get away alone?
Tomorrow. I promise tomorrow we'll go away together tomorrow. No more family for a while now, I promise. Now, turn off the light. Good night, Jackie.
Good night, Jack.
Good night, Bobby. Good night, Ethel.
Another kind of humor, if you want to call it that, was provided by the man who had been unsuccessful in his bid to become governor of California in November 1962.
As I leave you, I want you to know, just think how much you're going to be missing. You don't have Nixon to kick around anymore.
That, of course, turned out to be a somewhat premature prediction. A year later, on a sunny Friday afternoon in Boston, Massachusetts, inside Symphony Hall, orchestra conductor Eric Leinsdorf stepped up to the microphone.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have a press report over the wires that the President of the United States has been the victim of an assassination.
That gasp of horror was echoed by all of us who heard the terrible news. Edwin Newman, NBC News, was the anchorman of the radio coverage that day, and we've asked him to tell us what happened.
President Kennedy had gone to Texas to improve his political support there. Vice President Lyndon Johnson had gone along, as had Mrs. Kennedy. And that morning in Fort Worth, after receiving the traditional 10-gallon hat, the president was in high spirits.
Years ago, I said that, introduced myself in Paris by saying that I was the man who had accompanied Mrs. Kennedy to Paris. I'm getting that same sensation as I travel around Texas.
The presidential party then moved on to Dallas.
We understand there has been a shooting. The presidential car coming up now. We know it's the presidential car. You see Mrs. Kennedy's pink suit. There's a Secret Service man, spread eagle, over the top of the car. We understand Governor and Mrs. Connolly are in the car with President and Mrs. Kennedy. We can't see who has been hit, if anybody's been hit.
Then began the period of waiting. Two priests were reported to have administered the last rites to the president. I can remember announcing that myself. Finally, Frank McGee relayed this message.
White House Press Secretary,
Malcolm Kilduff has just announced that President Kennedy died at approximately 1 o'clock Central Standard Time, which is about 35 minutes ago.
The nation went into a weekend of mourning, but the somber, reflective mood was shattered on Sunday in the basement of Dallas Police Headquarters, where Lee Harvey Oswald had been taken. Tom Pettit of NBC News was there.
These people have given me a hearing without legal representation or anything.
Did you shoot the president?
I didn't shoot anybody, no, sir.
There is Lee Oswald.
He's been shot. He's been shot. Lee Oswald has been shot.
With the death of Lee Oswald, the shooting ended. The next day, after the solemn pomp and panoply of a state funeral, a horse-drawn carriage took the dead president to his final resting place on a slope overlooking the Potomac. A bugler played taps, and the 1,000 days of John Fitzgerald Kennedy came to an end.
So, as NBC Radio approached the end of its fourth decade, it was not the happiest of times for our nation. And as for the next 10 years, well, why don't we let your next host, John Chancellor, have a word here. John?
Arlene, I don't think it's any exaggeration to describe the years 1966-1976 as the most tumultuous and crisis-ridden in our country's history since the Civil War. I'm happy to say, however, we seem to have survived.
So am I, John. And on this happy note, I leave you. This is Arlene Francis.
This is John Chancellor, NBC News. We've arrived at the final 10 years of the 50 we're covering in our anniversary programs, 1966 to 1976. What a decade it's been, taking our country through its most dangerous national crisis since the Civil War, especially over Vietnam. In 1966, President Johnson took this position.
There will be some nervous Nellies, and some who will become frustrated and bothered and break ranks under the strain. And some will turn on their leaders and on their country and on our own fighting men. But I have not the slightest doubt that the courage and the dedication and the good sense of the wise American people will ultimately prevail.
Among those opposing President Johnson's views was the man who had helped a generation of parents raise some of the children who were now old enough to be sent to war, Dr. Benjamin Spock.
We will not acquiesce. We cannot. Our nation can and must stop this irrevocable rush to world war, this policy of American murder and devastation, in the name of national honor and pride, now.
What do we want? But despite the protests, the war went on, life went on. In 1967, we worked and played, cheered our favorite teams, the Cardinals won the World Series, went to the movies. Bonnie and Clyde was a big favorite. Marveled at the first heart transplant, and in Monitor's glass-fronted studio, Johnny Carson was interviewed by host Ed McMahon.
You've done so many different things. What are your plans after the Tonight Show?
I'm going to go to a movie, and want to have some dinner?
No. I mean after you finish up your current contract, some 3 years from now.
I wanted to go into the aluminum siding business. Very bad a couple of weeks ago.
So. I thought you've always said to me there was no business like show business.
Oh, there is. Yeah. Roofing business, hardware business is very, very similar. But I like the aluminum siding.
Ladies and gentlemen, our guest on
Monitor. Is that it?
Well, unless you have anything else you want to say.
Oh, my golly, I came up here, gave up a whole afternoon to come up here.
We have to go right on. We've got good fishing advice waiting in the wings.
Oh, is that what follows us?
Yes.
Good fishing advice.
And we plunge into some other important things.
Well, so this is it, okay.
It's awfully nice of you to come down and spend a few minutes with us here on Monitor.
Anytime.
That was Johnny Carson, ladies and gentlemen.
It'll be the last time. Don't expect to see me here again.
You see him at night a lot.
Brought him
in
here for 5 minutes and taken right out. Want to talk to me. In depth, you said. In depth. Questions like, how are you? I'm fine. What is that?
Thank you, Jerry.
We really needed the laughs in those days. As we moved into the late 60s, the country was divided, not only over Vietnam, but by something called the Generation Gap. Many of our young people were striking out in altogether new directions, sometimes with tragic results.
I smoke marijuana. I use LSD. I've taken methadrine and opium.
The drug subculture persisted, and other cultures developed as well. As always, cultural changes seem to be reflected in the popular music of the times, and we've asked Gene Shalit for some words to go with the music.
John, it wasn't just the words in this particular song that mattered to some members of the younger generation. The initials even held a message for them. Lucy, Sky, Diamonds, LSD. But not all of the new music was about dropping out and copping out.
This is the dawning of the age of Aquarius.
The Broadway musical Hair evolved out of protest by young people against poverty and bigotry and the Vietnam War.
These families, ask them how they feel about your son going to war, fighting, when he can't even get a decent job in America. My father fought in World War II. You know what? He's still a nigger. You know that? He's a veteran, but he's still a nigger.
And in their age of Aquarius, many in the younger generation saw an age of freer sexual attitudes. They took their clothes off, and a lot of their parents followed suit, or took off suit. Remember beautiful Anne Bancroft in The Graduate with Dustin Hoffman?
And here's to you, Mrs. Robinson. Jesus loves you more than you will know.
That movie mirrored the disillusion many young people felt with an older generation that seemed mainly interested in plastics. Get into plastics, young man. That was what The Graduate was told. But some young people began to get into something else. They got into religion. Not in the traditional forms, and definitely not with traditional music.
Jesus Christ, Jesus Christ, who are you, what have you sacrificed?
For some, religion was a challenge. And they challenged right back.
Who are you, what have you sacrificed? Jesus Christ, superstar. Who are you before, what can save you
all? For others, religion was a refuge.
My sweet Lord, my Lord.
There were those who were called Jesus freaks because they found salvation in him.
We were searching through dope, you know, I was shooting a lot of heroin, and we were confused. Then I finally asked Jesus in my heart, and I had no withdrawal from the heroin that I was shooting, and this miracle that was wrought in my body was too much.
That's just a small sample, John, of the kinds of music that accompanied the social changes in the past 10 years. And even many people who didn't approve of the changes enjoyed the music anyhow.
That's right, Gene. Gene Shalit, of course. Well, we've already described this decade as being one of the most crisis-ridden in our history. And the struggle by black Americans for their rights was a major part of it. In a quiet moment, Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. spoke with NBC's Frank McGee.
I know that your home has been dynamited and that you have had threats made against your life on many occasions. And I would like to know what your feelings on it are.
If physical death is the price that some must pay, if it's the price that I must pay to free my children and the children of my brothers and sisters and my white brothers from a permanent psychological death, then nothing can be more redemptive. If a man has not discovered something so dear and so precious that he will die for it, then he doesn't have much to live for.
Then, on April 4th, 1968...
This is an NBC News Hotline special report. Here is Don Hickman in Memphis.
Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. was shot outside a Memphis motel this afternoon. His condition is not known at this time.
With the killing of Dr. King, riots broke out in a number of big cities. Federal troops had to be used in Washington to restore order. And finally, a tense and unhappy country turned its attention to the presidential race. In Los Angeles, on the 5th of June, Robert Kennedy had been celebrating his victory in the California primary, and then... President Kennedy, then Dr. King, and now Robert Kennedy. It was almost beyond belief. But the presidential race had to be run, and after a riotous convention week in Chicago, Hubert Humphrey was chosen by the Democrats. His opponent, Richard Nixon. President Nixon, once he took office, had some very serious problems to contend with, and although he had campaigned on a promise to get us out of Vietnam, he soon had second thoughts.
What happens in Vietnam halfway around the world, and whether Americans meet their responsibility there, may affect the future of not only Vietnam, not only the other nations in the Pacific, but the future of America itself.
And so, despite announcements of some troop withdrawals, the end was not in sight. As is the case in times of great stress, some people sought solace in religion. On NBC Radio, we continued our tradition of presenting regular weekly programs in cooperation with the major religious denominations. Incidentally, for many years, it's been an NBC tradition to broadcast a midnight mass on Christmas Eve. Christmas Eve of 1968 was very special. The Apollo 8 mission orbited the moon and sent this greeting from a quarter million miles away.
For all the people back on Earth, the crew of Apollo 8 has a message that we would like to send to you. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth.
Each of the three astronauts, Frank Borman, James Lovell Jr., and William Anders, read a passage from Genesis. And finally,
we close with good night, good luck, a Merry Christmas, and God bless all of you on the good earth.
Then, just a little over 6 months later, the country, the world, was thrilled by this event.
We copy you down, Eagle.
And the next day, July 21st, 1969, Neil Armstrong became the first human to set foot on the moon.
That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
A new frontier had been opened. It may be centuries, it may be millennia before we really explore it, but it was a start. Before we move on through our most recent years, we'd like you to listen carefully to this report from NBC correspondent Howard Tuckner in Saigon, Vietnam, in 1968, outside the U.S. Embassy, which had been occupied by the Viet Cong.
Now the MCs are storming the U.S. Embassy. They have just broken the gate open. The more shots are coming. You're firing bazooka type weapons. It sounds like that from here. We're right on our stomachs in the gutter outside the U.S. Embassy in Saigon.
Like so many NBC newsmen before and since, Tuckner was risking his life to report the story. As a matter of fact, he was wounded covering another action just a few days later. And there were friends. Wells Hangen, who was captured in Cambodia and never heard from again. To this day, we don't know whether he's dead or alive. And George Clay in the Congo, killed in the middle of reporting the war there. Their dedication deserves, at the very least, this small mention. Here at home, on April 30th, 1970, the country discovered it had a larger war on its hands in Southeast Asia than it had thought. This news produced a new outburst of anti-war protest meetings. At Kent State University in Ohio, four students were killed by National Guardsmen, whose commander explained the shootings as retaliation for sniper fire. One graduate student, a research assistant, didn't see it that way at all.
When the firing started, there was no sniper fire. It was an immediate burst, and it continued. By this time, it was like mass hysteria. Students were crying. They were screaming for ambulances. I heard some girls screaming, "They didn't have blanks. They didn't have blanks." No, they didn't.
The Kent State tragedy heightened what had already been labeled the campus crisis, as students across the country not only protested the war, but demanded liberation from what they claimed were oppressive, old-fashioned educational policies. As a matter of fact, this was the decade of liberation movements, demands for an individual's rights became widespread. Not even our prisons were immune from this. Among them was Attica in upstate New York, where, in 1971, prisoners seized guards as hostages. One of the convict leaders rallied his men.
I appeal, beseech you all to stand with us, walk with us, die with us if necessary!
According to the convicts, conditions in the prison had been unbearable and the guards brutal. But outside the prison walls, wives and relatives of the hostages felt differently.
Brutal, my husband, brutal! I don't want to see anybody die either, but it's got to end somewhere.
It did. State troopers stormed the prison. 32 prisoners and 10 guards were killed. Hostages also had become the pawns in another kind of violence, airplane hijackings. One act of violence seemed to follow another almost daily. A massacre of 26 passengers at Tel Aviv Airport in 1972. Governor George Wallace gunned down during the presidential primary campaign that year. And then, one night in September, on NBC Radio, Bud Greenspan reported from Munich.
A day which began in tragedy has ended in even greater tragedy. After an evening of conflicting reports which began with news that the Israeli hostages were safe, it is now certain that 7, and perhaps all 9, are dead.
The Olympic massacre. We seemed then to be living in a bloody nightmare. Some people began to look back, wistfully, to the good old days when life was gentler. Nostalgia took over, and I'm going to ask Gene Shalit to take over again for a little while. One more time, Gene.
John, in the now nostalgic words of Rudy Valley, my time is your time. With Tiny Tim as a Pied Piper, we tiptoed back to the pleasant past, mainly back to its music. The Broadway musical No, No, Nanette was revived and it was a smash. And if there had ever been a Yes, Yes, Yvette, that probably would have been revived too. But there's no need to go to Broadway for nostalgia and music. We've got plenty of it right here at NBC. Let's start with a classic performance the night Fibber McGee led the Wistful Vista Businessmen's Band.
On the downbeat, the pizzicato polka. If anything happens, we'll go into Tipperary. 1, 2, spiel!
It could be that Fibber McGee inspired another NBC musical talent. No, not Toscanini, but a fella named Jones, who spiked a beautiful romantic ballad, Cocktails for Two, for the very first time on a Bing Crosby show in 1944.
In some secluded rendezvous,
that overlooks the avenue, with someone sharing a delight, a shack, a this, a that, with cocktails for two. As we enjoy a cigarette, to some exquisite chansonette, two hands are sure to slyly meet beneath the serviette, with cocktails for two. My head may go reeling, but my heart will be obedient, with intoxicating kisses for the principal ingredients.
I guess we could say they're not writing songs like that today, but then they don't have to, John. Not as long as there's an NBC musical memory bank to draw from.
That's true, Gene Shalit. Thank you. Getting back to the 70s, we find another somewhat unusual performance. A Chinese orchestra in Peking, China, playing Home on the Range. The occasion was President Nixon's historic visit to China. Mr. Nixon didn't know it at the time, of course, but aside from his re-election in 1972, this was to be perhaps the final triumph of his political career. The stage was set for an incredible chain of events that began in 1972. It was barely noticed at the beginning, just a small item in an hourly newscast on June 18th.
5 men, one a former CIA agent, are being held in Washington after being caught in the act of apparently trying to bug the offices of the Democratic National Committee. 3 of the men are native-born Cubans.
The burglars were convicted. White House aides implicated. And finally, on the 25th of June, 1973, before a Senate investigating committee headed by Senator Sam Ervin, John Dean began to testify.
The Watergate matter was an inevitable outgrowth of a climate of excessive concern over the political impact of demonstrators, excessive concern over leaks, an insatiable appetite for political intelligence, all coupled with a do-it-yourself White House staff.
In October, Vice President Spiro Agnew, noted for such alliterative allusions to the news media as nattering nabobs of negativism, resigned. After employing two non-alliterative words, no contest, in answer to a charge of income tax evasion. He was replaced by Congressman Gerald Ford. On November the 11th, at an Associated Press convention, President Nixon commented on various charges then being made against him.
I welcome this kind of examination because people have got to know whether or not their president's a crook. Well, I'm not a crook. I've earned everything I've got.
Month by month, the evidence against the president accumulated, and finally, a House subcommittee on impeachment headed by Congressman Peter Rodino voted on July 27, 1974.
Clerk will report. 27 members have voted aye. 11 members have voted no.
And pursuant to the resolution, Article 1, that resolution is adopted and will be reported to the House.
On August the 8th, President Nixon, rather than face impeachment, bowed to the inevitable.
I shall resign the presidency effective at noon tomorrow. Vice President Ford will be sworn in as president at that hour in this office.
There was one final act before the curtain fell. On the 8th of September, President Ford took this action.
I, Gerald R. Ford, President of the United States, by these presents do grant a full, free, and absolute pardon unto Richard Nixon.
The country was stunned, but the deed was done. And with that, Richard Nixon's political life came to an end. As we approached the close of NBC Radio's first 50 years, we found a world eager for news. We've gone all out to provide it. Kurt Gowdy was on hand when Henry Aaron broke Babe Ruth's all-time home run record.
Aaron, in his earlier days, used to hit more to right center than the left. That's a long drive. Balls it deep, deep. It is good. He did it.
Jim Laurie, NBC News in Saigon, was the first to broadcast the surrender that ended the 30 years of war in Vietnam.
General Nguyen called on all South Vietnamese troops to lay down their arms and remain in place. He announced a unilateral ceasefire and an unconditional surrender.
When the controversial supersonic plane, the Concorde, made its first commercial flight to this country, NBC newsman Steve Porter was there in the cockpit talking to the pilot.
Captain, right about now we are going twice the speed of sound.
We just reached twice the speed of sound at this time.
What altitude are we at right now?
We're just reaching a flight level of 50,000 feet.
What is your?
And when the U.S. space program reached a new milestone this year, Dan Blackburn at the Jet Propulsion Laboratories gave us the news.
There is a delay between the landing and confirmation because of the vast gulf of miles lying between Mars and Earth, and so it takes 19 minutes to find out whether or not, indeed, the lander is on the surface of the red planet. Those 19 minutes have just about... There, you can probably hear the cheers. Touchdown is confirmed. The Viking has landed on Mars.
And one really big event of 1976 began with this proclamation by the president.
I hereby proclaim that the 200th anniversary of the adoption of the Declaration of Independence be observed by the simultaneous ringing of bells throughout the United States at the hour of 2 o'clock Eastern Daylight Time on the afternoon of 4th of July.
And on that weekend of the 4th, from coast to coast, big cities and towns and villages, Americans of every size, shape, age, and color poured into the streets, paraded, sang, danced, participated in pageants, showed an affection for each other that had been all too rare. For those few golden hours, we had a glimpse of what the future could be. Well, we've elected the man who will lead us for the next 4 years, and he has told us...
I'm not afraid to take on the responsibilities of President of the United States because my strength and my courage and my advice and my counsel and my criticism come from you. And if I can tap the greatness that's in you and in the American people, we can make our nation's government great and a source of pride once again.
As we move on through the years ahead on NBC Radio, we'll continue to bring you the rich variety of sounds that reflect our times. We face problems, of course. The maintenance of peace, the pitfalls of inflation and unemployment, the continuing struggle for civil rights, and the conservation of our natural resources. But there's a bright side to life as well, and it could be that if we all work hard enough at it, we may be able to say, as one newscaster used to say many years ago, there's good news tonight. This is John Chancellor, NBC News.